You're seated in a circle. This circle is a visible symbol of an invisible unity. It is a primitive expression of the kingdom of God on earth as it is in heaven. The reason you are here, the motive power of your constancy in the cause of God, is the mighty covenant. The center of that covenant is Abdu'l-Bahá. Fix your gaze on that single lonely candle before you. There is light all around. You know that. But imagine what it would be like to see only that tiny flame in the darkest night. Utter blackness. Total lack of light. That candle is all the light there is. It weeps away its life, drop by precious drop. And you are terrified that a time will come when the visible flame must be extinguished. Constantly the candle speaks to you, pleading, commanding, cajoling, tempting. Offering, begging, it tells you, you are also a candle, and all you must do is ignite yourself on its flame. All people in the world must do that, and there will be perpetual light. Man will never know this dark night again. Consider, this was the condition of the Western world upon the ascension of Baha'u'llah. That candle was the mortal frame of Abdu'l-Bahá. The flame, heat and light, was the power of the covenant. Does it cross our minds that the Almighty has given us the perfect believer at the beginning of a dispensation. We won't have to wait 1,000 years for one to develop. He is Abdu'l-Bahá. He was created for that task. He was born to accept the revelation of Baha'u'llah on behalf of every man, woman, and child on this planet. The mind to contemplate. I've been told that he was once remarked that he knew the spiritual station and condition of every human being on the planet. Abbas Effendi, Mystery of God, the perfect man. My father was much with Baha'u'llah. One night, Baha'u'llah, as he walked back and forth in his room, said to my father, "At stated periods, souls are sent to earth by the mighty God with what they call the power of the great ether, and they who possess this power can do anything. They have all power. Jesus Christ had this power. The people thought of him as a poor young man whom they had crucified, but he possessed the power of the great ether. Therefore he could not remain underground. This ethereal power arose and quickened the world. And now look to the Master, for this power is his."
Say, verily the ocean of pre-existence hath branched forth from this most great ocean. Blessed, therefore, is he who abides upon its shores and is of those who are established thereon. Verily, this most sacred temple of Abha, the branch of holiness, hath branched forth from the Sadratul Muntaha. Blessed is whosoever sought shelter beneath it, and is of those who rest therein.
When Abdu'l-Bahá was in New York, he called to him an ardent Baha'i and said, "If you will come to me at dawn tomorrow, I will teach you to pray." Delighted, Mr. M. arose at 4 and crossed the city, arriving for his lesson at 6. With what exultant expectation he must have greeted this opportunity. He found Abdu'l-Bahá already at prayer, kneeling by the side of the bed. Mr. M. followed suit, taking care to place himself directly across. Seeing that Abdu'l-Bahá was quite lost in his own reverie, Mr. M. began to pray silently for his friends, his family, and finally for the crowned heads of Europe. No word was uttered by the quiet man before him. He went over all the prayers he knew then and repeated them twice, three times. Still no sound broke the expectant hush. Mr. M. surreptitiously rubbed one knee and wondered vaguely about his back. He began again, hearing as he did so the birds heralding the dawn outside the window. An hour passed, and finally two. Mr. M. was quite numb now. His eye, roving along the wall, caught sight of a large crack. He dallied with a touch of indignation, but let his gaze pass again to the still figure across the bed. The ecstasy that he saw arrested him, and he drank deeply of the sight. Suddenly he wanted to pray like that. Selfish desires were forgotten. Sorrow, conflict, and even his immediate surroundings were as if they had never been. He was conscious of only one thing, a passionate desire to draw near to God. Closing his eyes again, he set the world firmly aside, and amazingly his heart teemed with prayer, eager, joyous, tumultuous prayer. He felt cleansed by humility and lifted by a new peace. Abdu'l-Bahá had taught him to pray. The master of Akka immediately arose and came to him. His eyes rested smilingly upon the newly humbled Mr. M. "When you pray," he said, "you must not think of your aching body, nor of the birds outside the window, nor of the cracks in the wall." He became very serious then and added, "When you wish to pray, you must first know that you are standing in the presence of the Almighty."
To live the life is to be reverent, to cut our hearts from ourselves and from the world. Say verily, the branch of command hath sprung forth from this root, which God hath firmly planted in the ground of the will, the limb of which has been elevated to a station which encompasses all existence. Therefore exalted be He for this creation, the lofty, the blessed, the inaccessible, the mighty.
On one occasion, an unfriendly governor, hating these peaceful, honest Baha'is, thought of a plan for destroying their means of livelihood. He gave orders to the police. "There are 15 shops owned by Baha'is. Go tomorrow morning early, lock them up, and bring the keys to me." The master called the Baha'is to him that same evening and said, "Do not open your shops tomorrow, but wait and see what God will send to us." The next morning, the governor waited for the keys. Again he sent them. "Go," he said to the police, "and see if the shops are open." The police announced that the shops were closed. He waited and waited. At 10 o'clock, all the shops were still unopened, those shops which were always accustomed to open and be ready for trade at 7 o'clock. The governor was greatly perplexed. His plan did not seem to be working as he had schemed. The mufti, the chief mullah, came to the governor whilst he waited. "How are you?" said the governor. "Quite well," was the reply, "but very sad. Because of a telegram from Damascus, I am full of sorrow." "Show it to me," said the governor.
To his consternation, he saw that the telegram was from the Vali of Damascus, deposing him from his place as governor and directing that he be conducted by the police to Damascus. In fear, sorrow, and amazement, he went to his own house to make such preparation as was possible for the hurried and unlooked-for journey. The shops of the friends were saved. Abdu'l-Bahá, hearing of the misfortune which had befallen the governor, went to visit him. "You must not be sad because of this. Everything in this world changes. Can I do anything for you?" he asked of the erstwhile governor. "Now that I'm being taken away from them, there will be none to care for those I love. My dear family will be sad, lonely, and helpless, with nobody to counsel and aid them in their sore need. Do not be filled with grief, but tell me where you wish your family to go. If only they could go to Damascus. Now trust in me and let your heart be lightened of its distress. I will gladly send an honorable escort with your wife and children to Damascus. You will find that they will be there soon after your own arrival." The master sent the family with a trustworthy escort, providing mules and everything needed for the comfort of the journey. Quite a formidable undertaking in those days. The command was worded, "Take these persons safely and with great respect to join the governor at Damascus." A telegram was dispatched after they had set out. "I have sent your family to Damascus. They will very soon arrive in safety." When they arrived in Damascus, the governor, being greatly rejoiced, inquired of the escort as to the cost of the journey. "It is nothing. I am but obeying the command of the master." The governor then wished to give the escort a present for himself. "I desire no recompense. I am but obeying the master's command. I can accept nothing." When invited to stay the night for rest and refreshment, the reply was, "I obey the master's command to return without delay." "Then I pray you take a letter which I will write at once to the master." "O Abdu'l-Bahá," the letter read, "I pray you pardon me. I did not understand. I did not know you. I have wrought you great evil. You have rewarded me with great good." Thus was this enemy, who had indeed wrought great evil to the prisoners, repaid by being loaded with benefits.
To live the life is to do all our deeds in kindness. Should opposition or injury happen to us, to bear it, to be as kind as ever we can be, and through all, to love the people. Should calamity exist in the greatest degree, to rejoice, for these things are the gifts and favors of God. To be silent concerning the faults of others, to pray for them and to help them through kindness, to correct their faults. To always look at the good and not at the bad. If a man has 10 good qualities and 1 bad one, look at the 10 and forget the 1. And if a man has 10 bad qualities and 1 good one, look at the 1 and forget the 10. To live the life is never to speak 1 unkind word about another, even though that other be our enemy. O ye people, draw nigh unto it, and taste the fruits of its knowledge and wisdom on the part of the mighty, the knowing one. Whosoever will not taste thereof shall be deprived of the bounty, even though he hath partaken of all that is in the earth. Were ye of those who know.
One day, Abdu'l-Bahá, the interpreter, and I were alone in one of the small reception rooms on the ground floor. Abdu'l-Bahá had been speaking of some Christian doctrine, and his interpretation of the words of Christ was so different from the accepted one that I could not restrain an expression of remonstrance. I remember speaking with some heat. "How is it possible to be so sure?" I asked. "No one can say with certainty what Jesus meant after all these centuries of misinterpretation and strife." He intimated that it was quite possible. "It is indicative of my spiritual turmoil and my blindness to his station. that instead of his serenity and tone of authority impressing me as it warranted, it drove me to actual impatience. "That I cannot believe," I exclaimed. I shall never forget the glance of outraged dignity the interpreter cast upon me. It was as though he would say, "Who are you to contradict or even to question Abdu'l-Bahá?" But not so did Abdu'l-Bahá look at me. How I thank God that it was not. He looked at me a long moment before he spoke. His calm, beautiful eyes searched my soul with such love and understanding that all my momentary heat evaporated. He smiled as winningly as a lover smiles upon his beloved, and the arms of his spirit seemed to embrace me as he said softly that I should try my way, and he would try his. It was as though a cool hand had been laid upon a fevered brow, as though a cup of nectar had been held to parched lips, as though a key had unlocked my hard, bolted, crusted, and rusted heart. The tears started and my voice trembled. "I'm sorry," I murmured.
To live the life is to act with cautiousness and wisdom.
In the very early days of the knowledge of the cause of Baha'u'llah in America, Mrs. Getzinger was in Akka having made the pilgrimage to the prison city to see the Master. She was with him one day when he said to her that he was too busy today to call upon a friend of his who was very ill and poor, and he wished her to go in his place. "Take him food and care for him as I have been doing," he concluded. He told her where this man was to be found, and she went gladly, proud that Abdu'l-Bahá should trust her with this mission. She returned quickly. "Master," she exclaimed, "surely you cannot realize to what a terrible place you sent me. I almost fainted from the awful stench, the filthy rooms, the degrading condition of that man in his house. I fled lest I contract some terrible disease." Sadly and sternly Abdu'l-Bahá regarded her. "Dost thou desire to serve God?" he said. "Serve thy fellow man, for in him thou dost see the image and likeness of God." He told her to go back to this man's house. If it is filthy, she should clean it. If this brother of yours is dirty, bathe him. If he is hungry, feed him. Do not return until this is done. Many times had he done this for him, and cannot she serve him once?
To live the life is to be humble, to be hospitable, to be servants of each other, and to know that we are less than anyone else. To live the life is to be kind to all people and to love them with a pure spirit, to be a cause of healing for every sick one, a comforter for every sorrowful one, a pleasant water for every thirsty one, a heavenly table for every hungry one, a star to every horizon, a light for every lamp, a herald to everyone who yearns for the kingdom of God. Say, verily a word hath gone forth in favor from the most great tablet, and God has adorned it with the mantle of himself and made it sovereign over all in the earth and a sign of his grandeur and omnipotence among the creatures, in order that through it the people shall praise their Lord, the mighty, the powerful, the wise, and that through it they shall glorify their Creator and sanctify the self of God, which standeth within all things. Verily, this is naught but a revelation upon the part of the wise, the Ancient One. Thank you.
one day a woman asked to be permitted to see the master. "Have you an appointment?" "Alas, no." "I am sorry," answered the overzealous friend who met her in the hall, "but he's occupied now with most important people and cannot be disturbed." The woman turned away, feeling too humble to persist in her appeal, but oh, so bitterly disappointed. Before she had reached the foot of the stairway, she was overtaken by a breathless messenger from Abdu'l-Bahá. "He wishes to see you. Come back. He has told me to bring you to him." We had heard his voice from the door of his audience room, speaking with authority. "A heart has been hurt. Hasten, hasten, bring her to me."
To live the life is to be no cause of grief to anyone.
When the dreaded committee of investigation arrived from Constantinople, they abode in a large garden near the tomb shrine of Baha'u'llah. Enemies of the master at once busied themselves in sending documents full of false accusations. The people of Akka, being panic-stricken and full of fear, were careful to avoid any communication with the master and his family. Nobody dared to pay visits to them. Abdu'l-Bahá wrote to the committee, informing them that there were many enemies who were capable of forging and posting a letter in his name full of untrue statements. The committee assured him that they would be aware of and suppress any such document. After the investigations in Akka were completed, the committee proceeded to Haifa, where they examined the building on Mount Carmel. When they returned to Constantinople, they presented their report to the Sultan. The main points were three. 1. Abbas has made Akka a Mecca and Haifa a Medina unto himself. 2. He has made a banner with Ya Baha'u'llah Baha emblazoned upon it. With this he is endeavoring to foment a rebellion among the Arabs. 3. He, Abbas, is establishing his government in that neighborhood. Such was the report presented to His Majesty the Sultan at Constantinople. The master wrote to the Sublime Porte at Constantinople, replying to the three accusations contained in the report of the Committee of Investigation. "To make a Mecca of one town and a Medina of another town is not in the power of my hands to accomplish, therefore it is an absurd accusation. The statement that I have established a government in this place with myself as king is quite the highest honor you could possibly confer upon me, and the highest praise. For a prisoner so carefully watched and guarded day and night to be able to institute a government would be absolutely miraculous. Therefore the accusation is truly a tribute to my ability. Concerning the banner which I am supposed to have had made with that special emblem upon it, it is very strange that neither the Vali nor any other government official has ever seen it. Moreover, for me to possess such a flag and to carry it far and wide among the Arabs to raise a revolt would need the help of the angels of God to render it invisible to the sight of all others.
To live the life is to be truthful."
When the Sultan eventually received the report of that committee of investigation, he sentenced the master to banishment. But before the decree was carried out, the Young Turk Revolution took place. The Sultan was deposed, and the religious, with the political prisoners, were set at liberty.
Say, O people, praise ye God for its manifestation. For verily it is the most great favor upon you, and the most perfect blessing upon you. And through him, every moldering bone is quickened. Whosoever turns to him hath surely turned unto God, and whosoever turneth away from him hath turned away from my beauty, denied my proof, and is of those who transgress. Verily, he is the remembrance of God amongst you. and his trust within you. And his manifestation unto you. And his appearance among the servants who are nigh. Thus have I been commanded to convey to you the message of God, your Creator. And I have delivered to you that of which I was commanded. Whereupon thereunto testifieth God. Then his angels, then his messengers, and then his holy servants.
One evening after sunset, Khan came in great enthusiasm and excitement to our room. "Do you remember," he asked, "that Abdu'l-Bahá said he would answer all the letters we brought to him from America before we left?" "Yes, I do." "Then come quickly. It is too wonderful. The master is pacing to and fro in his sitting room. I cannot see the secretary, and he is replying to those letters as if he had known the inmost secret of the writers' hearts from the cradle. Yet he has never met nor seen one of them. You can see him from the corridor beyond the little door, the little room, each time he passes the open doorway." So, Rahim being peacefully asleep, I returned with Khan to his post outside the doorway which led to Abdu'l-Bahá's long room, with its many windows looking over the Bay of Aqaba to the Mediterranean beyond. I heard the dear master's beautiful voice, and then saw him as he strode by the doorway of his lighted room. We were in the dark, looking through the small, darkened antechamber. I recall how never at the daily luncheon table, and never at the late evening dinner, and never at any time had I satisfied my longing to gaze more fully upon the Master's beautiful, noble, and spiritual face. I used to glance admiringly at the snowy, scarf-enfolded headdress, and at the beautiful silver-white hair falling softly to the shoulders, and at the lofty arch of his forehead, at the expression of his eyes, indescribable in human language. Now they seemed blue, and now brown, and again partly of each color, or hazel, but always illumined, loving, and understanding, sometimes raised in holy reverence and silent prayer, sometimes gently smiling, but always kingly and supreme. Then I could never get my fill, so to speak, of the divine beauty of the lower part of his face. It expressed only a perfect sweetness, a heavenly divine perfection of spirituality, a gentleness, a holy patience, no sign whatsoever in lines or expression of the lower traits of human nature, only a divine perfectness. It was astounding. I'd never seen a face like it. Selfless. The stamp of suffering upon it. Alas for humanity which crucifies God's messengers. So I thought exultingly, now if only the Master would pause a moment in his doorway, as I am here in the dark, I could look upon his face to my heart's content and no one would notice me. Instantly the Master stopped in his doorway. Silhouetted against the light, I clearly saw him in his beauty, and I began a sort of visual devouring of that wonderful face. I looked, and I looked, and I looked. After a few moments, Abdu'l-Bahá withdrew and resumed his pacing to and fro in revelation of the tablets. After watching for a while, half timorously, the thought arose in my heart, oh, if only he would stop once more in the doorway. At once the master stood in the doorway, silent, and seemed to be looking upward toward the stars. Now I will look, I thought in breathless joy. This time as I gazed silently upon that matchless face, a golden light shone forth from his entire figure. This light intensified and intensified as I looked and looked until I began almost to be afraid. I said to myself, however bright it grows, I am going to keep my eyes open. What a wonderful sight! What a miraculous opportunity! The outline of light grew more and more intense, yet I looked and looked until it seemed to me I must fall upon my knees. Just as it seemed I could no longer bear such a vision, the master withdrew. Take me to my room, I said weakly, much overcome, to Khan. I've just seen the transfiguration upon the mount.
To live the life is to be as one soul in many bodies. For the more we love each other, the nearer we shall be to God. But to know that our love, our unity, our obedience must not be by confession, but of reality. Inhale the fragrances of the Rizwan from his roses, and be not of those who are deprived. Appreciate the bounty of God upon you, and be not veiled therefrom. And verily, we have sent him forth in the temple of man. Thus praise ye the Lord, the originator of whatsoever he willeth, through his wise and inviolable command.
Salutation and praise, blessing and glory rest upon that primal branch of the divine and sacred Lot tree. Grown out, blessed, tender, verdant, and flourishing from the twin holy trees.
Bless thou, O Lord my God, the divine Lot tree.
The most wondrous, unique, and priceless pearl that doth gleam from out the twin surging seas. Upon the offshoots of the tree of holiness, the twigs of the celestial tree, they that in the day of the great dividing have stood fast and firm in the covenant.
And its leaves, and its boughs, and its branches, and its stems, and its offshoots.
Upon the hands, pillars of the cause of God that have diffused widely the divine fragrances, declared his proofs, proclaimed his faith, published abroad his law, detached themselves from all things but him, stood for righteousness in this world, and kindled the fire of the love of God in the very hearts and souls of his servants.
As long as thy most excellent titles will endure, and thy most august attributes will last.
Upon them that have believed, rested assured, stood steadfast in his covenant, and followed the light that after my passing shineth from the dayspring of divine guidance. For behold, he is the blessed and sacred bough that hath branched out from the twin holy trees. Well is it with him that seeketh the shelter of his shade, that shadoweth all mankind.
Thank you. Thank you.